Thank you for tuning in to Katie and Kay. This is the Living Permaculture Show. I'm Stephanie Sison here with Jerome Ossentowski. Today, we're talking about a farming system that may be a fresh and novel idea to some of our listeners. Farming in the forest. Think your land has too much tree cover to grow edible crops? Well, think again. Our guest today is an ecologist, forest farmer, and educator living in New York State, where he passionately pursues work that connects people to the forested landscape and helps them grow their skills in forest stewardship. So I'd love to welcome our guest today, Steve Gabriel. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Excellent. So Jerome and I are really enjoying your book, Farming in the Woods. He just grabbed onto it and was so excited to get you on the air today with us. Jerome, what drew you to being so interested in this book so quickly?
Well, I went to the agroforestry conference in Virginia last summer, and Steve was there as well presenting and at a table, and we got a chance to meet. But there was a lot of agroforestry going on in Virginia, and I noticed that the NRCS was really promoting and funding technically and financially for different small farmers to get into agroforestry strategies, whether it was riparian plantings, mushrooms. We went on several field trips and saw a lot of that stuff on the ground. And I'd like to see how we could move some of those technologies and strategies into the western forests here, or play around with that idea. And we won't have much time to do that, but because we're going to talk about what Steve is doing there. But so that was what really intrigued me. And with my 25-year-old forest garden and my indoor forest garden, we're eating kumquats today. And I brought sprouts, kumquats, and spilanthes to peddle on my way back and my back haul sort of today.
Excellent. And so, Steve, can you tell us a little bit about what forest farming is, in case some of our listeners have never heard that term before?
Yeah, sure. So forest farming is one of what the USDA, anyway, considers five agroforestry practices, although globally and agroforestry writers and researchers like PK Nair have identified hundreds of different agroforestry practices worldwide. It's just that in the U.S. these five have been named, and so they say forest farming, alley cropping, silvopasture, windbreaks. We'd like to add forest gardening to the mix, which I'm sure Jerome is down for. That would be number six. Mm-hmm. And so all these have kind of different the one I forgot was riparian buffers. So these all have kind of different slants, but it's all basically incorporating trees and farming. And forest farming is unique in that we're actually starting with an existing forest. All the other practices, often we're starting with open fields or pastures or grasslands and thinking about how to bring trees in, with the exception of silvopasture, which can kind of come from either end and focuses on integrating livestock. So forest farming really zooms in on existing woods and other things to do than harvest just timber and firewood. So we like to think about fruits, nuts, mushrooms, medicinals, nursery crops, wood products that are other than firewood and timber. And there's lots of options to play with in there.
Excellent. That's a great description.
And Eric Tonesmeyer's book called Carbon Farming Solutions features a lot of these technologies too. He was a keynote speaker at that agroforestry conference, so we've had Eric on the show talking about his book as well. But this is a little more backyardsy, kind of 20 acres of forest where you can go in and actually get yields from it, and also do livelihoods, set up livelihoods, whether it was mushroom growing or berries or ginseng. And make a little bit of a living off of this as well, right, Steve?
I think that was a question to you, Steve.
I would say the thing I would add also, in addition to a livelihood, would be it's an opportunity to engage in good forest management. So we're actually able to take care of the woods at the same time and not do what's often thought of when people think of farming, which is I got to get the woods out of the way. So we're always looking for those mutual win-wins for both the forest ecology as well as for ourselves. And I'd say there's a lot of sort of hobby level and experimental things. And what we've been working with Extension and our kind of research is to figure out which of the list, the long laundry list, are really viable for the most people when they want to actually increase their income from their woods. So that list is much shorter than the whole buffet of, you know, things you could do in the woods.
When I like at the start of your book talking about how, like us, forest farming maybe sounds new to people, but we as a people, as a species, have been farming in the forests for a very, very long time. This is not a new practice.
Yeah, and I think it's ironic because we have to sort of, these days we name and identify these things that as novel, but they're really old, and there really wasn't a separation. We didn't have to define a practice of farming in the woods because long ago it was living. It was literally just inhabiting landscape, and there was, you know, not just a productive relationship, but something more intimate that I think is also at the heart of a lot of what people want to do when they think about farming in the woods, is connect and relate in a deeper way. And to me, there's no deeper way than recognizing that, you know, our native ecosystems that want to be here can also sustain us. So there's a really great relationship building piece in addition to the productive piece.
Absolutely. I feel that I don't do a whole lot of wild harvesting of medicinals because I feel that a lot of them are really at risk, but I do love to go into the woods and explore those medicinals and how they grow in those landscapes. And it's a great kind of work task that I get to put on the list is going to observe these plants in the wild a little bit more. And just any opportunity to get into the woods is really beautiful. So to be able to combine that a bit with our farms, and as you said, stop looking at the trees as something to get out of the way for our farm and really see how they can integrate into the rest of our farming system is really beautiful. Jerome's been stepping out of the kind of more traditional permaculture forest garden on his space that's really intensively cultivated and up into some of the back acreage and moving up the landscape in these swales and berms that are among the pinyons and junipers. And really, Jerome, I don't know if you want to speak to how well those swales are doing, but you can even in the winter when the snow's not down, when I was walking through a few days ago or last week, really just see how beautiful they're working.
Well, they're working for the wildlife more than they are for us right now. I had 40 turkeys yesterday when I was walking up to the cabin, or going up to my haunt, up to the tree. I have a three-hour walk up and down the mountain. So really, we can also harvest, you know, spirituality. We can harvest, you know, horticultural therapy by going into the woods. And that's another thing you're talking about, this bigger yield that we can get from Frank Lloyd Wright. He said, I believe in God, but I spell it nature. So, and you know, we have deer coming up on this area that we've been swaling, and we don't fence it, so we can't really control it. But with a lot of wild plantings and marginal plantings and volunteers, some years we get some good annual crops out of it, some years we don't. But the wildlife are there all the time, manuring, eating the ground covers and the grasses, and the mushrooms are coming in. It's not as intense as what you talk about in your book, but it's a start of working with the wildlife, giving them some space to be. And eventually you maybe need to take one of the turkeys out if you have a license and have it for Christmas or Thanksgiving dinner or whatever. So that's a possibility.
So, Steve, can you share with us a little bit about some of the crops you cover in your book that you are having some luck with in this type of farming setting?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the biggest entry-level crop, I would say, that we've been playing with and really working with, especially with growers in the Northeast, has been mushrooms, which mostly are inoculated onto logs. So there again, we can partner with sort of forest management and do some thinning of, you know, what mostly here we have lots of diverse tree species and lots of dense forests that are relatively young. And so some thinning can be done. It helps the forest, and we have all this material to work with. And I always bring it back to how that plugs into the ecology, because if a tree thins, if it's not going to be in the canopy long term, it's not going to be that old growth tree, it's going to die out anyway. It's going to eventually be shaded out, and once it dies, it's going to be consumed by one or multiple species of fungi and broken back into soil. And all we're really doing with mushrooms is we're sort of stepping in and saying, okay, well, instead of the native fungi that that nature might decide, we're just going to put this species in. Most of them that we work with are native species, and we're going to put that into play, and it's going to consume the wood, and it's going to build soil, and it's also going to produce a really high-value crop. So with mushrooms, we focused on shiitake, oyster, which is probably the most adaptable of all the species. You can find oyster on any continent pretty much in the world, except maybe Antarctica. Lion's mane, and then Stropharia red wine cap mushroom. And I've had a number of folks. My parents actually live in Colorado in the Denver area, and over time I've had contact with different folks in Colorado. And the interesting thing about mushrooms in a drier climate is I think there's actually good potential. The question is how to create a space for them to fruit that is that maintains a high enough humidity. And I actually think that that Jerome's greenhouses are a great example of a potential fruiting space, or it could be as simple as a fruiting tent, something with some plastic and just to keep that moisture up. But otherwise, I think it's a great opportunity for folks everywhere to start playing with. And since we started in the Northeast with mushrooms, we've had people go all over the world and start to we've had students go to Haiti, Jamaica, these different places in the world, and actually, you know, take mushrooms like shiitake, which originally is from a cooler climate in Asia, and grow them successfully there. So it's kind of a matchmaking process to figure out what wood species you have available or what organic materials you have available, because any organic material can be turned into mushrooms with a little bit of creativity.
Right. We, up at the greenhouse where I'm at in the winter, we've got reishi in the greenhouse on about 50 different logs, and they stay really nice and moist, and they're popping out really well. We also have a fella farmer in the valley, Shining Mountain Farms, and he's doing oysters available at Skip's Market. So we have a couple people playing with the mushrooms around here, and it's really nice to see them and really delicious to eat them, so we're glad about that.
Yeah, I like the idea of maybe, you know, spreading wood chips and sawdust in, say, in your berry patch or in your mid-story thing, and then inoculating that. You have a section in your book about that. That would be appropriate for people's backyards and in my forest garden as well, since we are, you know, we're adding more wood chips and woody materials in our mulching scheme anyway. Why not inoculate it at the right time and see if we can get mushrooms growing at the same time? So that's something I'd like to try this spring. Can you talk a little bit about that technique?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two species of mushrooms we recommend for that, and I totally agree, and especially in drier climates, when you think about integrating those two, you're already probably going to be watering those plants or irrigating or something, so then you're just also feeding the mushrooms. And again, they're in the mulch layer, and they're helping cycle that material. So red winecap Stropharia, and then the other one's Almond agaricus, which is a relative of the button mushroom. Those are both pretty easy to identify. The way I would distinguish the two is Almond agaricus really likes really clean, finished compost, the sort that you might put on a vegetable crop or something. They've been grown often with tomatoes, for instance, but then the winecap Stropharia is much more rugged and really likes wood chips, straw, organic, any kind of organic material. And that one's been really fun. We've inoculated that literally all over our farm, it's anywhere from full sun to part shade to full shade, and it's done well. It moves through the material really quickly, and then it often what happens is you actually miss here and there a mushroom that fruits somewhere. You don't see it, and it'll just send its spores and actually often colonize new material. So until a couple of years ago when we had a severe drought, we hadn't actually inoculated any new patches. We were just kind of finding them. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of this interesting hybrid between, you know, wild cultivating or foraging and sort of, you know, very intentional cultivation, where sometimes you have to do that, inoculate the landscape, and then it almost takes on a life of its own. So I think that'd be a great one to try.
Where do you get
really,
the spores?
Again, whatever material you have.
Where do you get the spores for that?
So for mushrooms, there's, you know, mushroom supply companies, just like seed companies provide different seed and such. We have an extension website that folks could access. It's cornellmushrooms.org, and on that website there's a supplier list. And there's two things I'd recommend when folks are looking for mushrooms. One is to find places that are relatively close to your climate zone. There's not any specifically in Colorado. There's some out west, definitely. And the other thing is to consider that mushrooms are incredibly adaptive to their environment. And so what would be really cool, and I think the long-term thing would be, is mushrooms can morph as they grow. And so if you want to breed a plant, you know, you need to often go through multiple generations of breeding. What's really interesting about mycelium is it actually will change its genetic composition to some degree, and also its adaptivity as it's growing. And mm-hmm. so people have bred mushrooms, for instance, to be adaptive to salt water. You can use oyster mushrooms to break down oil slicks that are in the sea. And so, but that wasn't a natural process. That was something that was done through some adaptive breeding. And so if you think about a drier climate, what really needs to happen is to take some of these species from climates that are often more humid and actually do some work to actually develop some strains that are really more drought and dry tolerant. And I think there's great potential, especially with oyster and the winecap strepharia, for that.
Excellent.
Great.
You are listening to the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio KDNK. We are talking with Steve Gabriel about forest farming. We just finished up a little bit of a lovely chat on mushrooms. And as we move into the next part of the show, Jerome, is there anything in particular you wanted to make sure we cover?
Yeah, one of your case studies you have in your book is a research station, Badgerstadt.
Badgerstadt?
Yes, in Canton, Minnesota. And they're doing some real interesting breeding on hazelnuts and also walnuts and hickories. One of the techniques is called swarm hybridizing. And I think that's happened on my forest garden in one particular, where I have a plum peach cup. Can we talk a little bit about what their breeding strategy is and what they're planning to do with that over the long term?
Yeah, I visited Phil Rudder and his family run that farm in the coldest part of the country I've ever been in, upper Minnesota. And it's a place where when he started, people said, you can't grow nuts up here. And he's really shown through 40 years of breeding and really high integrity research that's not the case. And hybrid swarm is really interesting. I think his background in sort of ecology and evolutionary biology really paved the way, because what happens as a global phenomenon is where two novel ecosystems meet, you have kind of a third edge. Sometimes those are called ecotones or ecotypes. And when you have species that are adapted to either of those extremes, when they come together, if they're a wind-pollinated species, what tends to happen is a lot of what he calls this sort of hybrid swarm, which is where you just have a lot of different genotypes and their pollen sort of mixing, and you get these novel breakthroughs that happen on a really rapid time scale. And so, for instance, what I really found fascinating about his approach was with the American chestnut, which, if folks haven't really read into that story, you know, that's a really interesting story in American ecological history, with that tree being so prevalent on the East Coast. It was rapidly wiped out by a fungus in the early 1900s. And a lot of focus since then has been on restoring the American chestnut, but really thinking about it as only using its original gene pool and sort of keeping it pure American. That's been a very big focus of groups in the East, whereas Phil and Badger Set has said, actually what we're going to do is we're going to bring together as many different types as possible. So at his farm, he's got American strains, he has Japanese, he's got European, Chinese chestnut, all sorts of things, and he lets them just, he plants them very densely together and basically lets all their pollen mix and then selects seed of the qualities and characteristics that he wants. And it, through that process, in a relatively rapid time, he's been able to develop something that's highly productive, highly desirable from a taste and edibility standpoint, blight-resistant, cold-tolerant in that case. I mean, the list just goes on and on. It's a really interesting approach that really draws upon the wisdom of the natural world, I think.
Yes. What were some interesting crosses that came out of that? Some unique.
Well, the interesting thing is, and this, he did this also with, he was doing that with for a cold hardy pecan, essentially a hickory as well. So he's mostly worked with hazelnuts, chestnuts, and hickories or pecans, which are the same genus. And it's funny because the crosses are, he doesn't exactly know what they are. It's not in traditional breeding where it's so controlled that you name, it's like almost like naming these hybrid varieties. And in the hybrid swarm, you kind of get the Badger Set cross. And he's got some different qualities that he's classified them for, but it's not in the same way where I can say, well, it's a cross of this much Chinese and this much Japanese. It's very much a mix. It's sort of more an approach where the proof's in the pudding, and if the nuts are great, that's what he's looking for. Some interesting but unknown combinations, unlike some of, often with breeding, we have a much more deliberate, sense of the proportions of one parent to the other or something like that.
Well, is that something that happened, is it similar to what's happened at my place where I have, a 20-year-old, 25-year-old food forest, and I have 200 varieties of apricots, pears,
yeah,
plums, and peaches. And one seedling tree turned out to be 3-in-1. I call it a plum peach cot. And I'm assuming that by some freak calling of nature, these crossed, and they created a seedling that has all those three unique fruits in it. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I think more or less. I mean, in this case, it's specific to the pollen structure of nut trees, and I think it happens across nature, and it can be both through wind-pollinated species. It can also be through actual, insect-pollinated varieties, things like that. People have looked, for instance, with pawpaw, which is another one we talk about in the book, where there are self-pollinating varieties. You don't need more than one to get good pollination, and I think you're well aware that once we bring diversity of species, we bring diversity of genotypes together, things happen that we don't even understand, and good things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Another one I'm thinking of, and I'm doing a lot of work now with silvopasture and with animals, I'm really interested in willow, and willow is this global species with, hundreds and hundreds of different genotypes, and the opportunity to do hybridization there is really interesting to me from a perspective of wanting to feed my grazing animals more tree fodder, because that's one, most breeding has been done for aesthetic qualities or for growth characteristics, but there's so much opportunity to think about increasing the nutritive value, the tannin value, which is a medicinal value, or the food value for them. So I think, we're thinking about for our farm moving forward is, how do we get a library started of these different genotypes and then look at those interactions. And maybe it's not something that needs to be so controlled. I think breeding has a long history of exerting our own control and will. And I think there's a lot of opportunity when we step back and do more of that observation and interaction.
Yeah, we're running out of time here, so I wanted to give our listeners your contact information. And I know that I've watched several of your videos, and you also teach at Cornell University. So why don't you talk about how people can get in contact with you and learn more about what you're doing, and your next book coming out on silviculture from Chelsea Green as well?
Sure, thanks. So wellspringforestfarm.com is our farm website, and also where we showcase a lot of classes and events that we do. The farmingthewoods.com is where the book information is for that book. and the Civil Pasture book that's coming out in this coming June, which is looking at the interaction of trees and animals. Really excited about that next chapter of exploration is just civilpasturebook.com.
Great, Steve. Well, it's been really great having you on. I feel like we've definitely just scratched the surface, but a good chance for our listeners to start thinking a bit more creatively about the spaces that they interact with and the possibilities to move forward with them and enjoy them in different ways. Jerome, do you want to give any contact information for our listeners in case they're looking for upcoming classes?
Well, we have classes coming up, and we have different things. We're doing a microgreen business now, so we could sell some microgreens, and you can look at our website, crmpi.org, for our upcoming classes and design course.
Great. And I would like to leave our listeners with a quote by Edward Abbey. May your trails be crooked, winding, lonesome, and dangerous, leading to the most amazing views. May your mountains rise into and above the clouds, and may your rivers flow without end. Thanks for listening to the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio KDNK, and we'll see you next month.